We all know the Jaws scale, and it works just fine for most movies. Jaws for an excellent film. Jaws 2 for an above-average film. Jaws 3 for an okay film. And Jaws 4 for a bad movie. But Alfred Hitchcock's body of work has demanded that we create new classifications. The Psycho scale. As Hitchcock's best-known film, which just happens to have several sequels, Psycho sets the pace. The Psycho scale has the same ranges as the Jaws scale. But we wouldn't want the master of suspense to feel like he's being disrespected.
Care whom I hurt, just so long as I answer all your questions.
I only want to clear a murder.
Caught in the tangled web of murder, three people confess the secrets that torture their souls. But in the echoes and shadows of the ancient city of Quebec, Canada, walks a man who knows the whole terrifying truth, but can never tell all the strange things his ears have heard. For he is sworn to silence. Grim silence. That points the finger of suspicion at him. Crushing silence that brings him the contempt of the people who loved and respected him. Deadly silence that leads him to the 13 steps of the gallows.
Examining his stomach, the doctors found that he could not have died before 11:30. Madame Granfo said that she left Father Logan at 11. A lot of things can happen in 30 minutes.
You're in love with me. You've always been in love with me. You haven't changed.
I have changed, Ruth. So have you.
You want me to pretend that?
Do you understand? I chose to be what I am. I believe in what I am.
Well, I'm not going to talk about it now.
What do you want me to do?
Whatever you wish.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? Or, as we could do this, Is It Psycho? we are continuing our look into Alfred Hitchcock's films, so that tells you, of course, I'm joined by my partner, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here today.
And we are joined by our usual Hitchcock people, Trey Hooks and Blaine Dowler. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
So this time out, I think, Blaine, it was your suggestion, but I'm not 100% sure, that we are covering I Confess from 1953, which, before it was suggested, the only thing I knew about this movie was that I've heard the title. So I watched it. I've watched it twice for the purposes of today's show, and that is the extent of my familiarity with it. But it's one of the things I have to say I'm enjoying about doing this retrospective is it's allowing me to see films that would definitely be on my want to see list, but that I wouldn't probably never get around to. So just in by way of a really quick synopsis of my first thoughts, my initial thought, which did expand later, but my initial thought when I first watched it is I thought this felt like an expanded version of an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. like, you know, I thought it was interesting. I thought it was very watchable, but I also thought it was kind of something where, you know, you digest it and then you move on and you don't really think about it much afterwards. So my thinking about it more afterwards was more because we were going to do this show. And then I had some, I don't know if I would call them deep, but deeper thoughts about it than the, you know, weekly TV show thoughts. But that was my first thought. How about you guys?
This, I agree with you as far as this retrospective being something where I'm a big Hitchcock fan. My intention's always been to try and see everything of his. I tend to fall in the category of though where when I go to, like, if something's on and, you know, it's on like American Movie Classics or something like that, that would be how I would encounter it. If they were doing, like, you know, a Hitchcock series, and I would usually jump from something new to then comfort food, you know, one of my Hitchcock favorites, which always gets in the way then of seeing all of the other ones that I haven't caught. This is one that was totally under my radar, and there's so much I want to say about this one. It was one, after my first viewing, I had a lot of thoughts on this one, and I wonder if this one's going to be one of those where we all had kind of a different experience with it. But there were some themes in this one that really struck me that I don't know how intended they were, but it was something with, I think, how the story went. A lot of it has to do with this thought of forgiveness and how it played out in this whole thing, because there's some interesting theming in this one that really struck me in a very strange way. But I'm glad to talk about this one today. This is the first time I've seen it, so.
It's the first time I've seen it as well, and I had trouble connecting with this one. Mm. I watched it twice, and both times I had a hard time not trying to pick the plot and the film apart. And maybe it's because it hinges on some aspects of a religion that I'm not intimately familiar with, to where, it never struck me that Keller was wearing a cassock. I just thought he had a normal coat. So I never got what made the two girls think it was a priest leaving Keller's house. So I kept going, well, how do they know he was a priest? You know, those kinds of things just kept popping up for me. So I had a trouble getting immersed in the film.
And just from my end, Paul, you are correct. This was my suggestion. It's my second time viewing it here. The first time was when I was trying to go through all of Hitchcock's films, but I had it... To keep it interesting, I was doing the oldest talkie I'd never, or the oldest silent film I'd never seen, then the oldest black and white I'd never seen, and the oldest color I'd never seen. And I had gotten far enough to hit this one. And I suggested it because I thought it could provide a fairly rich conversation, because I find it starts with a very interesting premise. And some elements of the execution are wonderful, like the cinematography. Other elements of execution, not so much. So I thought it would just give us a lot of meat on the bone for this particular talk.
Yeah, I thought as I was watching it the second time, because, you know, the first time I tried to immerse myself and just enjoy the story a little bit. As I watched it the second time, I did see a lot of what I thought were kind of Alfred Hitchcock's stylistic way of filming things. I didn't catch, let me put it better that way, because it's probably there. I didn't catch a lot of symbolical framing in this, which I usually do see in some Hitchcock movies. I didn't see a lot of that in this. It felt a little bit more, even though, like I said, some of the camera angles felt Hitchcockian to me, the actual story, I think it's why it lent itself to me to feeling almost like an elongated version of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, because it felt very, it's going to sound insulting to say by the numbers, but it felt like I'm going to present this in a way for you to see it best, as opposed to I'm going to present this with messages in it, if that makes sense. And I'm curious if you guys kind of, you know, viewed it with an eye towards that, and if you observed anything, maybe you saw more than I did as far as symbolic framing or anything like that.
I did see some. For me, what really stands out for the symbolic framing is when the priest is actually on trial. And if any listeners haven't, you know, maybe we should give them a quick rundown of the premise behind this if they haven't actually watched it yet. But a parishioner kills a man, confesses to his priest, and the police investigating rightly pick up on the fact that the priest is hiding something, and they accuse him of the murder, and he cannot clear himself without breaking the seal of the confessional. And like, to me, the most symbolic imagery is when he's actually on the stand and he's asked point blank, like, do you know what happened? And his response is not, no, I don't. It's, I cannot say. And when he's saying, I cannot say, the way it's framed, it's a low angle shot. And there is a crucifix on the wall behind him that's filling the other half of the shot, right? And that's kind of looming over his head the way it's angled. So he is restricted with that. So it eventually comes out, the police officer, who is played by Carl Malden, by the way, he picks up on the killer's wife and sees, oh, there's something going on here. And as it turns out, the secret that he's hiding is that the murder victim had been blackmailing the priest because of a relationship he had before he became a priest with a woman who married somebody else.
Yeah, now we're getting from the symbology to the story, but the story, I felt the story had a lot of layers to it, and I think Sean alluded to that a moment ago. As far as the priest, his obligation towards the person he had a relationship beforehand, his obligation towards somebody who confesses to him, the actual killer and his motivations. And I'm going to start there because I just found that a little bit fascinating. Because when the movie starts, you know, we get some build up to it, but very early in the movie is when he makes the confession to the priest. And the killer actually works at the rectory where the priest is stationed. He seems to me to be truly repentant at that moment. At least that's the way it presented in my mind. That he did this, it was a moment of passion or desperation, and he actually felt a level of guilt about it. And that's why he was confessing it. And then as the movie goes on, little by little, he becomes less and less sympathetic of a character, to the point at the end where, you know, when there's a big confrontation, I don't want to go as far as to say you're happy to see him get gunned down, but you are against him at that point. And they make it very easy to be against him, through his, callously allowing the priest to go through what he does, and then the actions he takes, you know, beyond that, which are just unforgivable. So I just enjoyed that development of the character to us. I don't think the character actually changes. I think our perspective of him changes, and I thought that was well done in the movie.
Yeah, he pretty quickly goes to actively evil. You know, I mean, and I'm wondering if maybe they missed a trick there. You know, obviously the backstory with Montgomery Clift's character and Ann Baxter's character is important to the plot, but beyond that first night, we don't ever really see Keller sweating it. So, you know, it would have been really interesting to have these two counterpoints between this one guy who's almost pushed to how far can he go before he admits the truth versus, you know, how far can the priest go and keep his vows. But pretty early on, like, you know, Keller's planting evidence in Logan's room, and...
That's where I was totally convinced this guy was not repentant at all. His going to confession is not about repenting, and it's one of the areas where, out of this, I started to find it more intriguing. And it was my second viewing, more than anything else, that, like, all of a sudden I'm like, oh, there's something here that I don't know if it's intended for me to be as interested in. I don't think he's repented at all. I think he is evil. I think he made a choice there. I think his going to confession is, I think he fears the idea of going to hell. I think he fears the idea of being damned because he's what he's done. So he's like, hey, safe zone. If I go to confession and I say, I did this, give me forgiveness, he isn't apologizing. He's telling this to the priest because he wants the priest to absolve him. So that way he's now in the clear. Like, hey, it's all good now because the priest has cleared me. And he does this later in the film as well, after he basically is shooting at the priest. He's shot his wife. I know I'm jumping ahead, guys, but I mean, it's...
No.
But I mean, when I'm looking at that, you know, particular theming, he asks for forgiveness after he's, like, ready to die there. And everything he did there, he only mentions the fact that he did it because he thinks the priest has betrayed him. There's nothing that he was doing there was, like, that was intrinsically... He doesn't even seem to care too much about the fact that he shot his wife. I mean, I found him fascinating as a villain in this piece. In my first viewing, I didn't feel this way. It was my second viewing that I was really down on him, and I found it in a... like, I was emotionally charged about him, and because I feel like the priest was absolving him at the end, and this guy was not really apologizing. He was, you know, he was looking for, hey, free me from this so that way the worst doesn't happen to me, because he's convinced he's done this evil thing, and hey, if you absolve me, I won't go where I'm, like, intended to go. I might actually be with my wife. Because he believes it. He believes in the whole religion thing. I do believe that. But I don't think that he's genuinely repented at all.
That always makes me think of a scene in a sitcom, and I'm tempted to say it's Louis De Palma in Taxi, where he's having a conversation with a priest, and he's saying, so you mean if I'm on my deathbed and I confess, I can just go to heaven? And somebody interrupts, and you know, they're like, come on, Louis, we got to go. And he's like, wait a minute. I think I found the loophole here. And the priest is trying to say, no, you have to really feel bad for what you did. And I found that interesting from this perspective on this, just to take that comedy bit and take it to this movie. When I first saw him confess, my thoughts were that he was being genuine. And maybe I'm wrong about that. But if he was being genuine early on, and he confesses and gets forgiven, and I'm looking at this from the church's point of view, but then later on he almost pulls back the feeling repentant and no longer feels guilty about it because he's been forgiven by the church, and it kind of revels in his own evil, does that forgiveness go away? I think it does, because the second part is a sin just like the first part is.
Here's where I don't think he was repentant. Everything he was doing was about covering his tracks. And if you take a look throughout the film, he's constantly worried about being discovered. He's worried about the priest saying something. He's letting the priest take the fall for this and fall on the sword for it. And just basically keeping his mouth shut. Like, and he was going there to shoot the priest. He brought the gun to shoot the priest if he needed to. I mean, he's not sitting there going like, hey, like, I did this terrible thing. I never want to go do it again. He's ready to do it again to cover his tracks. That's not a guy that's repentant.
The first killing was a robbery gone wrong. He did not walk into there intending to murder. And I think everything he did after that, as Sean is saying, nothing is motivated by conscience. Everything is motivated by trying to avoid the punishment and consequences for his actions.
Yeah, I think I probably looked at it too much on its surface level when I watched it.
Yeah, so I think if anything, he might have been a little guilty about killing the guy at first because it's a much more serious crime than the one he had intended to commit. But once he realized that the police would not come after him because they were going after the priest, and he could make sure that the priest got punished for it and he'd be okay, well then, oh, he's happy because, again, the punishment would be avoided. And so I think that's why I find this film so interesting, because both Keller and Logan, so the killer and the priest, are deeply concerned about the laws laid out by the god they worship, not as concerned about man's law. And the priest is just prioritizing God's law above man's law, which is something that a man who deserves that role, right, who should be a priest, I think that is the way they should behave. And this is coming from an atheist. But, you know, Keller's doing it the other way, where, yeah, he is trying to go through the motions to get that absolution so he can stay or keep going to heaven. But it's not about what's right and wrong.
I have to watch this again now. And that's what's great about this podcast. Because as Sean was talking, I had the revelation that everything that Blaine just said may be true. That's what we're told. But we never see the crime. We just know what Keller says in his confession. He took a gun with him to go to Valetti's house. So, you know, maybe there was always that thought in his mind. It gives a really different kind of reading to Keller.
It could. I do still think, though, that first killing, I think bringing the gun was the backup plan to avoid getting caught for the robbery. I don't think he said, I'm going to kill this man when I get there. I think he said, I am going to rob this man and make sure I can get away with it.
Yeah, I don't believe that the original intention was murder. And I don't even believe it was really seriously considered by Keller going into the robbery. But I think, you know, I in his mind, I think the gun was brought for his own protection. But, you know, what I like about this and what this discussion is giving us is that he is a somewhat nuanced character instead of just being a pure evil villain. He's clearly evil, but he's not pure evil. It's slightly distilled evil. So I like that aspect of it. Whereas Montgomery Clift's character, now I'll say my exposure to Montgomery Clift coming into this is the movie Red River. I still haven't sat and watched Judgment at Nuremberg, which is something that's on my viewing list. But that's what I know him from. And he played a pretty pure character in that movie. He plays a probably couldn't be much more pure character in this movie. His motivations are all, you know, totally good. And he's willing to take the punishment for this crime if it comes down to it, rather than, you know, break the sanctity of the confession. So when you have a character that's that good, it's very easy for them to be two-dimensional. I think he plays it well, though, because I think you see in his mind, like the way he speaks and the way he looks throughout it, he's constantly judging himself and his own standards, and can he do this, and should he do this? Should he just come out and say, hey, you know what, Keller came to me and told me he did it? That's constantly running through his mind, at least the way it appears in this thing, especially to protect his, you know, Ruth. Especially, you know, to protect Ruth, which, you know, it seems to me, you know, her safety is more important to him than his own. And he's willing to totally sacrifice everything just to protect her. So, you know, there's a lot going on in his mind, even though he is a pure character, but you see that he's tortured by it. And I think that's, you know, played really, really well by him. I think he was cast, you know, very well in this movie, which I'm going to give that stage to you guys in a moment. But I had just seen, I didn't realize beforehand, the same year this came out, there was a radio play of this same story which is apparently available on YouTube on something called Lux Theater, where Cary Grant played the part of the priest. And I may have to listen to that because that sounds very interesting, just to see how he plays the character.
Yeah, Lux Radio Theater is a good one. And actually, my own old-time radio podcast, inspired partly by these conversations, we are, at the time of this recording, we're going to be 3 weeks into going through all the Hitchcock films that have been released on radio. So I can pull up when that podcast is going to come out. Yeah, that's slated on my podcast for February 2nd, 2025.
Well, there you go. Everybody, if you don't want to go look for it yourself, wait for Blaine to put it in your hands.
What struck me, and this is part of what kept going through my head as I was watching the film, and this is where I mentioned, being aware of the broad strokes of Catholicism, but not being Catholic, not knowing the intimate details myself, was there a middle road here that would have been safer for Father Logan that he could have taken? Like, does the seal of confession prevent you from saying that you took a confession? Like, could he have said, Keller came to me that night and confessed something, and that's my alibi, but I can't tell you what he confessed. I don't know what the rules are.
No, I'm pretty confident that I'm a lifelong Catholic, but I'm not trained in to be a priest, so I haven't gone through all of that. But I believe he's not allowed to reveal what was said to him or provide it through any type of innuendo. So if he says Keller came to me and confessed something that night, he's basically saying to the police, "Hey, wink, wink, he did it." So he can't do that.
Okay.
What was intriguing about that was he's this pure guy, and he's completely played that way. And it was actually when I was doing some research on this one, I saw that I don't want to say they butted heads, but like Hitchcock would get frustrated with him because he was very method acting in this. And I saw multiple references to the fact that that was how Cliff approached this. He is this very straight-laced, likable is kind of a strong word on this one, because I don't know, and it sounds like a criticism, I don't mean it that way. He was playing the character he was supposed to be playing. He was this priest who really believes in what, his role is. He's committed to this path and this course, and it's very, very genuine. Because of that, though, and he's, handsome and dashing. That part is, like, pretty critical, because I needed something to believe that Ann Baxter was really in love with him, because we see him so much as the priest. You've got to believe that this was this woman's great love at a certain point. And that was with him, for some reason, that part I was having trouble with. When the flashback sequences, just because he played that same character in the flashbacks, he's just kind of always been that guy. She sold me on it. The casting in this was pretty good. And she wasn't supposed to be Ruth. There was another actress that was supposed to be Ruth.
Anita Bjork. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I really think she worked out pretty well in this one, because I liked her and her, seeing him through her lens. It sounds like I'm bashing him. I'm not. I thought he did a good job. But he is this very kind of chaste and pure character in this one, where I found this difficulty. I was very sympathetic to what he was going through and had a lot of respect for the fact that this is his code. And he is sticking to his code. So that part I actually really liked, and I thought it felt different, seeing that that's kind of what was causing the problems for him. But because he was playing this kind of pure, straight-laced priest, I had trouble connecting with him and feeling like that's my buddy, which a lot of films where it is the person that's been victimized, I feel like, hey, what have you just done to my pal? I didn't feel that with him, and it's strange to say that's not a criticism. It's really not. He's doing what he's supposed to be doing with that character.
Yeah, Montgomery Clift is a great actor. You know, both he and Ann Baxter are largely forgotten today, I think. And, you know, that's a shame. You know, she burst onto the scene as Eve Harrington in the classic All About Eve. It's also Zelda the Great on the first season of Batman.
I know it from the Ten Commandments.
Montgomery Clift, he does so much acting with his face in this film, more so than with the dialogue he's given. And for our listeners, I'll recommend A Place in the Sun if you want to get a better sense of Montgomery Clift's range, where Red River is also a great movie, but to where he's playing a completely different type of character in that. But you really see him physically wrestle with the dilemma. I know some critics at the time cited this film as being padded, and while it wasn't suspenseful in maybe the typical sense, one of my favorite scenes in this is when he kind of goes for that long walk to think things through before he ends up in LaRue's office. Because every stop he makes, you can tell what he's thinking and what he's wrestling with.
Yeah, and back to Sean's point, yeah, Clift did a great job, but we did need Baxter to sell the love story because his character on paper is very stoic. He does not show his passions outwardly. So Clift is playing the character as scripted very well, but that means, you know, the emotions, that heart is not out there on the sleeve. He is stoic. And we really need to sell that on the backstory because, you know, in real life, while they were filming this movie, he started dating Jack Larson. You know, it all comes back to Superman. So the Jimmy Olsen from the George Reeves series were introduced while they were making this. But no, I think you guys are bang on. Like, his facial expressions, he's maintaining an almost neutral expression, but his eyes act so much and tell so much of the story. In this, he lets us kind of see the gears turning and when they're turning and how hard they're turning and, you know, what he's focused on. It really helps sell the undercurrent. So this is one. Hitchcock was not satisfied with it. He actually almost regrets making it. He thinks they should have done a different film instead for reasons I've been deliberately coy with to see if we pick up on the same thing and it comes out in the conversation. But yeah, Clift, Baxter, Malden, I'm blanking on the name of the guy who played Keller, but yeah, the casting in this is not the issue.
See, I think with Ruth's character, I think the story is well laid out to give you the contrast. If you just have her there proclaiming her love for Father Logan, I think that just falls a little flat. But what you have is they show what her home life is like and her married life is like, and you see that it's a totally loveless marriage and that she's settled for this. And she makes no bones about it. She doesn't try and pretend, you know, life is so good, let me pretend that, you know, put on a show for everybody. She pretty much, you know, lets it be, you know, okay, yeah, I'm going to live the life and I'm going to play the part, but I'm with this guy out of convenience more than anything else. I love Father Logan and that's never going to change. So, you know, I either accept that he's no longer available or I live a tortured life. And she's chosen to not live a tortured life so much because she's gone on to this comfortable life. But she, again, doesn't pretend to be in love with her husband. And you know, comes right out and tells him so. So then when she's showing why it is that she's settled for this and how she does have this anguished love affair with Father Logan, you know, then it all kind of plays together. And, you know, it's up to Anne Baxter to pull all of that off. And I think she does do it really well. But, you know, the story lends itself to that, I think, you know, really well as well.
Well, especially because I think because of the subject matter and the types of characters that were in it, Hitchcock was handcuffed somewhat. You know, he was relying on the cooperation of the church to get the film made, to have access to, you know, I'm sure they built some sets, but he really wanted to film in and around churches that were in Quebec. So there really couldn't be a sense of impropriety around Father Logan in the present as a priest. And I think that limited what he could have Montgomery Clift do, and I think that put most of the weight of conveying the relationship on Anne Baxter.
Not only could they not show any sense of impropriety in the present, they received criticism for the scene of the kiss, which is before he was a priest.
This film was not shown in Ireland because of that relationship.
Yeah. Hitchcock was very, very mad at I forget where it was. One of the places they cut out those elements.
I think it was Ontario. Very,
yeah, they cut it out, and you know, he felt that they like ruined his film by taking certain elements out. One of the things that I thought this film did well, or at least I found intriguing, was the stuff they didn't show. Trey mentioned it earlier, the fact that we don't actually see the crime. So we're left with the facts that were given, but we don't see. What happened that night with them? We see certain elements of it, but not all of it.
Yeah, and, well, it's left to our imaginations whether anything actually happened in that gazebo.
And we're left to deal with the facts that we're told. Very much like the jurors and, you know, having to look at the case. And I like that choice. I mean, because it was something that was a bit different. I also like the choice with the relationship. We keep talking about Anne Baxter selling the relationship. There's kind of the typical thing where the guy goes off and he's made this commitment to go off to the military and all that. And she would have some bitterness with him. That didn't happen. It was she had her life plan, which was to go off with him. He had a different plan to go to, very similar to what we see when he becomes a priest. You know, he makes his commitments and he passionately believes in them, and that's what he is, and that's who he does, and that's what he those pieces. She never gave up on that love for him. I did not get the idea that he still had that love for her, or maybe had the same love for her. That, and I'm not knocking the relationship because of it. She sold me on how she felt, which sets up why she has set her life path the way that it is. She went into a loveless marriage because of the fact that she could not let go of this relationship that she had with him. I feel he deeply cares about her. And you could argue there's different kinds of love. And I certainly would say that he loves her, and that was, you know, in from that respect. But it's not the same. At least I didn't feel that in watching it. I actually found that intriguing because I think that's real. And I felt like it was something different that was being done in this that kind of takes it aside from, I think, how you typically see relationships like this play out in a film. And that part was, I'm like, oh, there's some things in this that I felt were like some really good attempts at doing something different. And that's where I agree with you, Paul, to a certain extent. It does feel like an extended Alfred Hitchcock Presents, because some of those programs, that and Twilight Zone and things like that, some of my favorite episodes are the ones where they get kind of experimental and they're trying to tell the kind of story that you normally can't do as a film. And I think they were trying to do that here. And some things really, for me, really worked. And at least in getting my thought processes going. It's an interesting sort of film because I'm in a few different places with it. But
I think that you know what you saw. I think we're in agreement. But I think you know, he had a passionate love for her before he went away to war, and possibly something affected him while he was away or whatever. But when he came back, he still loved her, but it was a platonic love at that point. I don't think he had the passionate love for her anymore. And I think that was in its own way, that's kind of like a little bit of the tragic story here, is that she still deeply loves him passionately, but he doesn't. He's now dedicated to his position with the church. And again, what you see and what you don't see, which is what you just mentioned, Sean, and what Trey alluded to earlier, you know, you don't know what changed him while he was away. Was it the seeing the death of young men? Was it, you know, having to kill somebody himself? What, you know, what occurred while he was away that changed his way of looking at life, that he could no longer be the person he was? And I just, you know, I think that gives a depth to the story that you don't need. It's not even show, don't tell. It's allude to, but don't tell, and then move on. And I think that's well played here. And this is, you know, this is a relatively short movie. They could have thrown stuff in there. You know, this is 95 minutes long. They could have thrown another 10 minutes in to give a little bit more background on that. But I don't think it would have made it better. I think it would have just made it a little slower moving, honestly.
Do you think they rushed to the ending? So, you know, ultimately, Father Logan's found not guilty, and there's a really ugly crowd outside, and that's the moment Alma, Keller's wife, breaks and says something, and he shoots her. Should there have been another 10 minutes where Father Logan has to live a day with this innuendo and suspicion of no one trusting him and thinking that he was really guilty, or do you think the ending was paced okay?
I think it would have been interesting to see the Father Logan dealing with that for a while, but if Mrs. Keller and Mr. Keller have the opportunity for a private conversation, I think Mr. Keller would have smacked her down verbally or emotionally, and she would not have spoken up. I think to get that turn, her act had to be immediate.
So or you could have done something.
It feels
something,
like it's one or the other.
You could have done something where he smacks her down, she acquiesces, and then it's, you build up the drama or the level of conflict with the crowd or with the public to the point where she just bursts and can't take it anymore. And she breaks free of his influence. It would have definitely been an interesting psychological study for Alma and for what is his name, Otto, as well. But I don't know if it would have, I think it would have been interesting, and I think it would, might have been superior that way, but I don't know if it would have been commercially accepted.
Yeah, and you'd also have to set it up so that her outburst is in front of the police officer who's prosecuting, because that's how, right, it was her outburst, and all that seemed, their interaction with all three of them together is how he twigs to the fact that, oh, yeah, Logan didn't do it, it was Keller.
I'm so torn on this because, as you're saying, you know, the extra 10 minutes and what that would have been looking like, I want to see it, and for so many reasons. But one of the reasons when Keller's confront, you know, when Keller's like been found out, and, you know, there's the gun sequence and all that, he curses the priest at a certain point. And I found that was one of the areas where that I feel that, like, this guy's not repentant at all. He says at one point that I'm not going to shoot you and kill you because it's worse to keep you alive because of what has happened to you now because of this. This is a completely innocent man. That's only connection to this is the fact that he heard a confession. And Keller is cursing him to a life of now, which is, you remember, this is a very, we're very used to nowadays, like, you can clear yourself via the internet and the media. There's a lot of ways to get the word out. The damage that this film ends Like, it's one of the things I wanted I wanted 10 more minutes on the end to kind of see what his life was going to be like, because Keller paints a picture that doesn't go away because the inspector, you know, Carl Malden's character, knows now that he's in the clear. This whole town, the way that they looked at him, that is something that Father Logan is never going to go away. That happened. And that's something that's still going to be stuck with him. There's still going to be people that are going to question what happened with him and Ann Baxter's character. The damage to Father Logan has been done. Some of it might be lessened because of that revelation, but what Keller cursed him with actually is still a thing. So he absolved him at the end, even though what Keller said to him actually, that's the part I want to see, is like, we're saying the same thing, whether it's the 10 minutes or the 10 minutes after. I kind of want to see what that looked like. I guess I more wanted to see it afterwards, because what's Logan's like, okay, now that it's out, as much as it can be in this era, what is his life going to be like after this? Because it doesn't totally clear up everything for him.
I think that I'm sorry, go ahead, Blaine.
I was going to say it absolutely doesn't. When I was in seventh grade, one of my classmates who was not allowed to hang out with her friends after school figured if she doesn't tell her parents about early dismissal, she could spend an extra hour hanging out with her friends. Only her parents knew about early dismissal, and when they were saying, where were you? She made up a story about one of the staff members, not remembering that early dismissal means staff meeting, meaning he was standing up in front of the entire faculty as department head, saying, here are my plans for the year. The girl's friends came forward after these accusations, going to the police, going, this man did not touch her. She's just mad because she didn't study for the test he gave that morning, and she failed it. So completely false accusations, but he had to change schools because 2 years later, people were still saying, why is he still teaching here after what he did to that girl? Well, he didn't do anything to that girl. He was convicted in the court of public opinion, not the court of law. And the court of public opinion does not have the same standards for evidence.
I think the court of public opinion in this is interesting because, one, I do think the fact that Otto shot Alma in front of everybody clears Father Logan of the murder of Valette. But what came out at the trial about his relationship with Ruth is going to stain him in the public eye forever. And consider it from that perspective, too, that, you know, we talked about Ruth's situation. She loved him enough that she basically sacrificed the comfortable life she has, because now that's not going to be the same either.
What's great about this film is you can shift the camera left or right and come up with so many different stories. Because y'all are 100% correct. And the film that I also want to see is the Willie Robertson story. The prosecutor knew Ruth and her husband socially, wasn't really sure about Laherne's case all the way through, didn't really want to bring it to trial. But boy, when he does, he goes after Ruth. What happens to that relationship afterwards? Does he get invited to the next dinner party? What's that like?
Yeah, that's he was just doing his job, but
exactly.
that doesn't mean that people are going to forgive him for just doing his job. I think the relationships, I think Ruth's relationship with everybody is now different than it was before. And her life is different, and maybe she does have to adjust and go live somewhere else, because she's going to constantly be subject to whispers under people's breaths everywhere she goes.
Yeah, there is no concrete proof that she's an adulteress, but I'm sure at least half the town believes she is.
There was no concrete proof that Logan killed anybody, but the town believed that too.
Mm-hmm. Her husband played a good role too. Roger Dan, who played husband, I thought he did a really good job of being, he loves her. I mean, and that's kind of it. But I thought one of the things he did really well is after all this came to light and you got to see some scenes with them, you could tell he was different. And he was still caring, you know, aware of what she was going through, but you could tell there was a different distance between them. It was subtle. It was done through the acting. And I thought he did a very good job of conveying that he is in a different place without it being over the top, because he could have, you know, kind of showed a ton of anger towards her and things like that. I felt like that would have taken away from the fact that this guy knew that she didn't really love him the way that he loved her, but yet still loves her. I felt like that still felt like it was there-ish, but I felt like there was something different. And I love when you see things through acting that, like, isn't explicit. And I feel it's there was some scenes in this that were very well acted. And he's one that, like, is easy to get lost in this. And I thought he played kind of a pivotal role, because you got to sell you on the fact that, like, this guy is a really good guy who really does care about her, because she's living a pretty good life. You could almost look at Ruth and go, you've got everything you want except the wrong person is there. Everything somebody could want, you know, as far as you've got, you're pretty solid and secure, and clearly she's well dressed. Seems like life's not a bad thing for her, but you can't manufacture love.
Yeah, you get the impression that she could be happy with this man if she had never met Logan.
Yes. Right. Yes, good point. What did you guys think of the level of the murder investigation? Did they give up on looking deeper too quickly? Did they accept just, you know, the peripheral information and just say, let's go after this? Should they have been listening to Father Logan's protestations a little more and saying, let's investigate this a little further? You know, he couldn't give them anything definitive, but he was, you know, constantly saying that he was innocent of it. Should there have been more? Was it realistic for them to just accept it and go after it? And to answer my own question before I give it to you guys, I do think there is a level of, if we think we have the right thing, we're done. And I think that happens in real. I think that's somewhat realistic.
I think so, because as I alluded to at the top of the podcast, all of their investigation really hinged on two girls saying they saw a priest leave Valette's house. And with what is visually shown, like I've watched the scene three times. I know what a cassock is, and maybe it's because he wasn't wearing all of the regalia. It doesn't look to me like Keller's wearing a cassock when he leaves Valette's house and the girls see him. So that one circumstantial tenuous link is what they build the rest of their case on. Now, once they start going down that path between finding the cassock and Father Logan's belongings, the perjury from Keller, they probably had enough to bring forward a case. But what got them looking that direction was pretty tenuous.
It wasn't just the cassock, though. If you check, Carl Malden noticed through the window that Logan and Ruth met outside. They were there with no clear cause. So he was able to intuit something is up here. Something doesn't fit right. I mean, Hitchcock movies are not known for having particularly capable policemen, but this is one of the more capable policemen he's had. So I can see this as very realistic, where, you know, Malden's character there says there is something going on here. Something is not right with these guys. And he pursues and pursues and pursues. And, like, to Paul's point, where they think they've got the answer, he's sitting there going, it's walking like a duck. It's quacking like a duck. We probably have a duck here. And it's not until he sees the dynamic with Keller and Logan together, when Keller is armed, that he goes, oh, okay. With Logan, it is just the woman, and he had no part in the murder.
Not only does he see them there with no reason, but when he questions him, he's very, very evasive. So that's got to make you suspicious as well. And there was something to be suspicious of. It just wasn't the murder. Mm-hmm.
The thing that I liked about how that was playing out, we saw a couple of times where it looked like the light was at the end of the tunnel for Logan, like, being cleared. Ruth comes forth and starts sharing her story, and it looks, at least for a brief period of time, looks like, Logan might get cleared here. Where's this going to go from there? But it was still that timeline, that half hour from 11 to 11:30 became an issue then, and she also, through her being truthful, now added a motive onto him, which they didn't have that before. So it was as the investigation kept going. I like that it kept being an investigation. I also like that Carl Malden's character and Robertson weren't in full agreement as far as how to as this got further down the rabbit hole. Carl Malden's character actually pulled Robertson aside, LaRue, pulled Robertson aside and was kind of like, wait a minute, hang on a minute. Are we going a little bit too harsh into how we're doing some of this? I liked those subtleties in there because I felt they were real. I felt like Malden's LaRue was seeing evidence put before him that, like, okay, the motive's here now. And that time window from 11 to 11:30, nobody can clarify that. And even Logan's own retelling of the story starts to put that in doubt. So you don't have anything else in that moment to look at. There was nothing at all pointing at Keller. There was nothing pointing at a potential other killer. And I felt like the investigation part of it, the fact that it kept going on, I'm glad that we didn't have a cut and dry investigation very early on in the film and that facts kept appearing along the way to kind of back up taking a look at Logan. That was a piece that I thought worked well. I liked Carl Malden's Inspector LaRue quite a bit. He was an interesting sort of character. Whereas Robertson, I did not like. He became more and more more self-serving, and like he's out to win this case, and with a passion, and he doesn't care about what friendships are burnt or bridges are burnt along the way. It's I am going to get them, and I, no matter who gets hurt along the way, I am going to put you on the stand. I'm going to grill you until I get every possible fact I can, so that way the end result's cut and dry. I did not feel that way at all about LaRue. I felt like LaRue was a really good inspector who was trying to uncover what was really happening here. And I thought Malden played a really good character.
Yeah, they had a really good dynamic, because you're right. When the case was in investigation mode, Robertson was, I really don't like where you're heading. I don't know if you've got it. And Laherne was just on it. I'm right, I'm right, I'm right, I'm right. And as soon as the handoff happened, Laherne became, well, I don't really like the conclusions that you're drawing in your prosecution. I don't like the things you're saying, the innuendo that you're putting out there. And Robertson was like, you set it up for me. I am driving this thing home.
See, there is an ethical consideration for the attorneys in this situation. In a criminal case, the defense counsel, their ethical obligation is purely to their client and to do what's best for their client. End of story. If they can get, even if they know their client is guilty, but if they can get them off, that's their obligation. The prosecutor has a very different ethical obligation. The prosecutor's obligation is towards the truth, really. So when the prosecutor is given a case, their job isn't just prosecute this at all costs and get a guilty verdict. If information comes to light to the prosecutor that, hey, there's something wrong with this case, they are ethically obligated to kind of come forward with that. So it makes, I think, the prosecutor's job much more complex and much more difficult, because they don't have that single focus of, you know, I just have to prosecute this case and try and win. It's not just win or lose. It's an obligation towards the truth. And that does make it more complicated here. And you know, Willie Robinson seems to be of a mind of, once you put this on my plate, I'm going to try and win it at all costs. And he kind of maybe gets a little sketchy with that ethical obligation.
If I'm inviting him to a dinner party, it's only because I'm keeping my enemies close. it's not because I want to hang out with him socially.
I don't disagree. Any other characters that stood out to you guys?
You know, we've talked about her, or talked around her, and I'm not familiar with her career at all, but Dolly Haas's Alma Keller, I mean, you can see her sweating it all throughout the film. How long is this going to go on? What's my husband going to say? At what point does this end? So I thought she brought a lot of tension and suspense to the drama.
She did, and I think you could remake this film where she's the lead and still have a very interesting story.
I think you could probably make this film where, and I think it's good because it's disproving my simplicity of an Alfred Hitchcock Presents argument. I think you could present this from virtually every character's perspective and have it be an interesting film.
Yeah, you could do either Keller, Logan, Ruth, or Carl Malden's character. Any of those five could easily be the lead in this.
You could even do Willie Robertson, that he's given this case. I think that's that shows a complexity that escaped me when I was first watching it. So I have to appreciate that. The score in this, I have to confess, really just didn't stand out to me. I didn't have any significant thoughts about it. It didn't jump out to me at any point. So if any of you were listening to the music a little bit more carefully and have an opinion, please advise me.
You know, I have almost nothing to say about the score, and I sit down to every movie we watch for this podcast thinking score is going to come up, so I should pay attention, and it still just slipped past.
Yeah, that doesn't mean it's bad. In fact, it could mean very good things about it. It could mean that it's so subtle that it just didn't stand out to us. And I always say that the score should not call attention to itself. It should just emphasize what's going on. Just to kind of reiterate my thoughts on that, you know, even in a movie like, say, Raiders of the Lost Ark, where the score does jump out at you, the first time I saw that movie, it didn't. It emphasized it, and it was clearly there and changing my mood and whatever, but it didn't, I didn't walk away going da 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 da. It wasn't until later that really became imprinted on my mind. If I'm watching a movie the way I think I should, I'm not going to necessarily be conscious of the score. It's going to influence me without that, and I guess it did in this case, because I just, again, it just didn't imprint itself on me at all. So I can neither say it was good nor bad. I guess this is the point where we do our Where Was Alfred feature.
So at the 93-second mark, he was walking up the stairs. This was very early in the film. Not quite as early as, say, Rear Window, which we'll get to, but it is one of his earlier cameos. I think that's wrapping up. I do want to also talk about why Hitchcock was unsatisfied with it before we give our Jaws ratings.
Sure, why not?
Sure.
So I don't know if we want to do that now, because it looked like Trey had something to say there. For those of us on video.
I was just going to say, I misidentified Hitchcock then. I thought he was coming down the stairs from the church like the morning after the murder. So I misidentified him.
I'll back you up on that one. I ended up afterwards, just for the purpose of validating, you know, did I find him? I did know where he was and went back and saw where he was, but I did not discover him. I thought that was him too. And it turned out it wasn't, but I'll completely back you up. That is exact. I'm like, great. I got him. I found him. Yay. I did.
I totally missed him in my first viewing, but I saw him the second time around. And I have to confess, the second time around, I had looked it up and I knew where to find him.
Yeah. Which, honestly, sometimes you have to, not so much in this era where it was the 4x3 or the narrower ones, but some of the CinemaScope films, if you're watching the pan and scan version, he will have been cut out because a couple of his cameos in his widescreen films are at the edge of the screen.
Mm. And I know when it became a big deal that he was in every one, he expressed a desire to put it in early so that people would stop looking for him.
Yeah, that's what he found, is a lot of the big fans were not relaxing and getting involved in the film because they were too busy checking every extra to go, is that him? Is that him? Is that him? So he started doing it earlier and earlier and earlier so that they could relax and really get into it.
Okay. And I guess we are, you know, you mentioned the Hitchcock's dissatisfaction with the movie, and then we kind of went over. Yeah. My understanding is he was unhappy with the editing when the standards committee took out the kiss and all of that, which was not universal, but in certain areas, they had a priest from the Catholic Church as a consultant on this, and he was apparently very critical of anything that showed Father Logan in anything but superhuman form, really. And I think that was a problem in Hitchcock's mind.
Go ahead. But a lot of that for Hitchcock, those are external problems. And the reason he regrets making this is he found he didn't have the right balance between the humor and the serious. He found in general his British films leaned a little too far into the humor, and especially his early American films leaned a little too far into the serious, but you need to have that mix, even if there's not a joke, but just some lightness, some sort of morbid humor, so that you have a tension release for the audience. And I felt the finished product here didn't have any of that. It was dead serious start to finish, which can be stressful and weigh on the audience. So yeah. That was why he was dissatisfied with it. So, I mean, we talked about how this could be remade with really at least 5 or 6 different lead characters. And I think this is one that, you know, I'm not usually a fan of remakes, but I think, yeah, this is one that could do it, because one of my main issues with remakes is they tend to take movies that were successful and do them again as a cash grab. If they're going to remake something, I'd rather remake something that missed the mark the first time, but had a lot of potential. And yes. I think that's this film. Before we get to the Jaws ratings, this concept has tremendous potential that was not fully realized.
I think it was more realized as we discussed it than it was as I watched it. I it's one of the reasons I enjoy having these conversations, is it's not just me getting on and just giving out my opinion and walking away. It's us having a dialogue about this, and sometimes my opinion changing to an extent, or me seeing things that I previously didn't notice, which I always appreciate. I think there's some subtleties to the performances and some subtleties to the script that I did not see without our discussion of it. So I've got to appreciate that. Going to the Jaws ratings, or the Psycho ratings, as we will for our Hitchcock movies, since Psycho is the one Hitchcock film that we have multiple. Well, I guess they did do a sequel to The Birds of sorts. But anyway, we're going to go with Psycho, since there have been at least 4 Psycho movies, and we'll just graft the Jaws ratings onto them. So,
yeah, although I think the Psycho films would probably end up being rated like the Jaws films, where would you actually rate them?
Probably. but we, you know, again, we go with the standards that we've set for the Jaws ratings. Anyway, I want to say this is a Psycho 2, that it, you know, because of all the things that we've discussed. But I think the bottom line is when you come down to rewatchability and memorability, I'm going to say, you know, a month from now, I'll kind of have moved on from this one, and I'm not going to be saying, oh, let me see it again or whatever. I thought it was good. I thought it was a very good character study. I thought there was some good suspense here. I thought the performances were top notch. But overall, it was just, you know, again, I come back to my initial thoughts that it felt like an hour and a half version of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which is not an insult, but it's not going to be, you know, the most memorable movies ever. So I'm going to give it a high Jaws 3, but that's where I land with it.
I really like this, and but I totally agree with the rating of High Jaws 3, and the reason being is exactly what you're saying, the rewatchability factor for me on this one. I do think I want to give it the highest possible Jaws 3 you can, though, and tell people if you are a fan of Hitchcock, you should see this film. I mean, it's definitely worth watching. I enjoyed the experience of watching this film. I actually am going to watch it again with my wife because she came in during my multiple viewings, like partway through it, and I said, "Don't come in now because like you're going to discover things that you don't want to discover that way." I do think like I want to sit down with her and watch it again. I want to see it again from that perspective. So I mean, it's a good film. It was not one of those where it was like painful afterwards. And my criticisms of some of the characters, they should be criticisms of them. They were just well played. So it's got something interesting. I agree, Paul. Was not thinking at all Alfred Hitchcock Presents until you mentioned it at the start of our recording. And I couldn't agree with that more either, because I actually really like Alfred Hitchcock Presents because of its experimental nature. And this feels like what he was trying to do here on this one. So definitely see this if you are a Hitchcock fan and you're trying to, you know, there's other Hitchcock movies where we've got one in particular we've already done that I would say you could pass. This is not one of those. This one you should see if you are interested in that. It's just not going to be on my short list of I've got to go and rewatch this Hitchcock movie. This was a good one. Glad we did it. High Jaws 3.
Just to follow that up for a moment, when I give the Alfred Hitchcock Presents comparison, that isn't meant to be really an insult. A couple of years back, they were showing two episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents every night on one TV station that showed old things. I don't recall which one. But I was DVRing it every night until I saw every episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I definitely felt that was a quality program. So when I say it felt like an episode of the show, that isn't meant to be blasting it.
And I should clarify, I meant High Psycho 3. And to Blaine's point, yes, they could. I think they could fit the same term.
Yeah, I think I said Jaws 3 too. So it's a Psycho 3. Psycho.
Yeah.
Wow. Before we started recording, I was at Psycho 3, and I was like, I'm going to be giving the lowest score to this film out of the panel. But as we started talking about it, we kind of talked it across the Psycho 2 line for me. So I'm going to be at a low Psycho 2. I have to go rewatch this one now with some of the things in mind that we discussed in it. So I'm going to go low Psycho 2.
Honestly, I was coming into this with the mind that if it was just the script, right, had you handed me the script and said, what is this going to come out at, I would have picked a Psycho 3. But like Sean, I'm saying Hitchcock fans should watch this, but I'm going to throw in some caveats with that. I'm going to say watch it when you are not multitasking, because so much of the value of the film is in the nuance we get in the performances. And if your eyes are on a different screen and you're just following the soundtrack, you're going to miss a lot of what sets this apart. I'm also going to say don't watch it alone, or at least watch it at the same time as someone else you want to talk about it, because that's where so much of the value is, I think, is going through the discussion and the ethical dilemma that's here. That's actually why I did suggest it, because I think this is a great ethical dilemma. So I would say if you were watching this alone and multitasking, you'd walk out as a Jaws 3. But I think the performances and the, if anything, the unrealized potential also pushes it. And I keep saying Jaws and Psycho. It should have been the Psycho 2. Got to get used to doing it. So I'm with Trey there, where if you watch it under the recommended conditions, I think you'll find the Psycho 2.
Fair enough. I'm not disagreeing with anything you say. Okay, so now that's it for I Confess. But what's next?
So just so the audience knows, the way I built this plan, I went to Letterboxd. I sorted all of Hitchcock's films by popularity, and then I cut the list in half. So we'll be jumping from the most popular film you haven't talked about to kind of the middle of the road. So the most popular of the low half. I don't plan to release this partly because those ratings can change and they can shift, and partly because we reserve the right to watch something else because it's topical or a remake scumping or just because we bloody well feel like it. But if we go through it that way, the next film in the list is Vertigo.
Okay, I think that one's going to inspire some real conversation. So I'm going to look forward to this. I haven't seen Vertigo since the 1980s when it was finally released or re-released, and you know, full exposure, I was not as enamored with it as people tend to be. So let's see now, you know, whatever it is, 40 years later, what I think of it. I'm going to look forward to that, and I hope that our listening audience will make a point of watching it before it comes. You know, we don't do these that frequently, so you have plenty of time to watch it. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and thank you guys for coming on again. This is always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Paul.
You see, with a murder, one has to jump from one detail to another. Forgive me, perhaps I jumped too suddenly for you.
Well, it seems maybe I don't follow as fast as you jump. I have a methodical mind. I do have to take things one by one.
So do I. So do I. The difficulty, perhaps, is that well, we aren't thinking from the same point of view. Could it be that, Father?
It could be. I don't really know what your point of view is.
Oh. Well, then I put it badly. Very badly. Let me try again. Now, this lady that you met outside Villette's house.
I wish I could discuss her, but I can't.
But who is she?
She isn't involved.
That is for me to decide, Father.
I know, but you'll have to take my word for it. She's not involved.
I respect your word, but I need your help.
I'm not able to help.
I see, of course. I just don't want all this mystification to make things too awkward for you.
Awkward for me?
A priest was seen leaving Villette's house at the time of the murder. I saw a priest outside Villette's house the next morning. Well, Father?
Well?
Too much mystification might lead one to believe that both priests were one and the same, mightn't it? What have you to say?
Well, what would you want me to say?
That is up to you, Father.
Well, then, I would say that a man of intelligence would not be led to believe anything on so little evidence.
You are perfectly right. We have checked on every priest in Quebec. Each could account for his movements at the time of the murder. That is, each except one. Where were you at 11 o'clock, Father?
I was walking.
Alone?
No.
Good. Now, if you will just give me the name and the address of the person.
I can't.
Father, don't you want to help me?
I've done my best.
But you refuse to answer my questions.
I'm sorry. I know. It isn't possible for me to answer them.
Well, it's a pity. A great pity. Good night, Father. I'm deeply sorry.
Good night, Inspector.
Deputy Mr. Robertson. Yes, the Crown Prosecutor.